Radar shows the rain is closing in on us. Now 68 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha, humidity at 93%. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:10, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for WGTD and the morning show comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, now newly reimagined for 2019. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. JackandDrea.com. Morning show starts in just a little bit.
For the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show, I am speaking with Paul Beston about his first book, and it's a great book, called The Boxing Kings, When American Heavyweights Ruled the Ring. This is a book about a legacy that now seems to have all but vanished. That is the legacy of the proud American heavyweight boxing champion of the world. For almost all of the 20th century, that title was held by a series of talented Americans, each their own distinct personality in and out of the ring. And it's a extraordinary and proud legacy that now has shifted in quite dramatic ways now. And as the author says in the foreword to his book, probably many of us would be unable to name the heavyweight champion of the world today. And whoever that is, they are not an American. And so something has shifted drastically in the sport of boxing. But in Paul Beston's marvelous book, endlessly fascinating book, we are taken back through the 20th century and actually even into the late 19th century for the beginning of the story, to meet a series of exceptionally charismatic and intriguing champions. And he focuses special attention on seven of these champions, all of whom loom as mighty figures in the history of not only boxing, but the history of professional sports. The book is published by Roman and Littlefield, again called The Boxing Kings, When American Heavyweights Ruled the Ring. And Paul Beston, we welcome you to the morning show.
Hi, nice to be here.
I'm really happy to have this opportunity to speak with you. I want to spend just a couple of minutes, if we can, talking about your own personal connection to the sport of boxing. And you explained that this happened way back in 1976 when you were 10 years old. Tell us what happened when you were 10.
Yeah, I grew up in the 70s and then the, you know, early 80s. I was a teenager, grew up in a sports loving house. My dad was a devoted baseball player in his youth, and loved all the major sports. And so there's plenty of sports around the house. But one of the things that I began to be captured by was this sport of boxing, which I should note was on television a lot back then, and that's one of the kind of a crucial part of the story, because its availability was so much wider than it is today. So I was catching it on Saturday afternoons or Sunday afternoons, and even Muhammad Ali, who was such a presence back then and was still champion, would sometimes fight on regular TV. He'd come home from school on a Friday night and he'd have a big fight with being broadcast by Howard Cosell. I mean, it was a big event. So the sport really began to attract my interest, and I've thought about it many years since, and what was it? And I I certainly think that the individual nature of it was a big part of it. I was fascinated by the fact that it was a solo sport, and the kind of loneliness in a way that that great fighters embody. I mean, just coming down that aisle toward the ring is such a dramatic moment, but it's also a very lonely moment. And I remember very well as a kid. In fact, I still feel it now when I watch a fight. I feel knots in my stomach, almost on their behalf. And I was putting myself in their shoes and wondering how anxious and how much, you know, what's going through their mind as they're going to do this thing, this great public act of being tested in such an arena where you really can't hide. And other team sports, you can hide. I mean, you could be on the bench for the big inning, or you could be out there and the ball doesn't come to you. But the ball always comes to you in boxing. You know, there's just nowhere to hide from it. So I think a lot of those factors played into my interest. And then finally, there was just the human element, the characters. They just reached out and grabbed me. You know, it wasn't like I had to work too hard at it. They were so captivating. And then, so it wasn't just the regular TV. I just started going to my local library and taking out books on boxing history. And that's how I started to discover some of these guys who are in my book.
Right. You tell us that you had absolutely memorized the number 796.83, which in the old Dewey Decimal System were the boxing books. Tell us about the films that you watched, the films that you were able to get from a now defunct company called Ring Classics.
Yeah, you know, this is, of course, a pre-internet age and really, except for, I guess, a small segment of people, a pre-cable TV age, too. I mean, our house didn't have cable, so it was just regular television. And, you know, actually seeing this stuff, these old fights, there was no readily available way to do that back then. And now, when I put in my bibliography, I say that YouTube is probably the greatest gift to boxing fans since the Marquess of Queensberry rules. You know, it's like a playland. You could go in there and type any fight, and for the most part, they'll come up, and you can watch them to your heart's content. But back then in the 70s, I was reading about these fascinating fights of Jack Dempsey or Joe Louis or Rocky Marciano, but there was no real way to ever see any of this except an occasional clip or something on a special. And then I discovered, because I had found Ring Magazine, which was the flagship boxing magazine. They had these ads in the back for old Super 8 millimeter reel-to-reel fights. And I was just always ecstatic by that. And, I began to collect some of those and got a movie projector and watched them down in our basement, you know, turning off the lights and putting up a white screen and projecting them up on the white screen. And they were silent films. They would turn quietly in the dark, the reel-to-reel. And it was black and white, and I would be watching, Rocky Marciano against Jersey Joe Walcott or Joe Louis against Billy Conn, these fights that I'd already read quite a bit about. And now I eagerly anticipated seeing them unfold in the way that I had read. And that was really, I sometimes wonder if I would have gotten into it in the same way. It's a curious thing. Scarcity has a kind of way of fostering passion, I think. I wonder sometimes if I'd had the YouTube at my fingertips, whether it would have had the same kind of magical spell that it cast on me. I'm not sure.
Right. I suppose in the same way that certain people who become very devoted film buffs and became film buffs maybe 40 years ago, when you really had to go out of your way to, for instance,
right,
scare up a copy of Citizen Kane. You didn't have sort of limitless opportunity to tune it in whenever your heart desired, but you had to really work on that devotion in order to find the things that would satisfy the hunger. And I think you're right. It would have been an entirely different experience for you if all of this had maybe been at your fingertips easily.
Yeah, I really do think so. In fact, I had to hunt quite a bit to get Ring Magazine, too. It wasn't on my town's local newsstands, and I managed to finally locate it just by chance on a family trip in Kansas. I grew up in the Midwest, and we were just driving around looking at colleges for my older sister, and I was in a drugstore, and there it was. I said, "My God, I've got it, you know." And, I bought it, and, sure enough, there was a card in there to subscribe, and then that was it. I was hooked in, thank God. You know,
over the roof.
How am I ever going to find that thing, you know? And it took a while.
Right. I don't know if you've actually said this yet. I don't think I've said this yet, but not only were you fascinated by boxing, enthralled by it, but you also yourself boxed. And I believe, if I remember correctly, your brothers also were boxers. And I'm curious to have you just talk for a moment about making that sort of leap from just being interested in the sport to actually wanting to step into the ring yourself, which is quite a different thing. Right from the start, did you want to box, or did that come later, and what was the catalyst for that?
Sure. I should just be clear, when you say in the ring, I never went into a real ring. We're talking basements and later on racquetball courts and makeshift things like that. I never did pursue any kind of formal interest in boxing. I never did go to a gym, but I did box for many, many years with my two older brothers especially, and we did it for years together. So, yeah, I think it came, the interest in trying it came along fairly early. One of us, must have been my oldest brother, started acquiring some of the equipment. So that would be the Everlast gloves. And, you know, they sold these gloves in, you know, in a Sears or I don't know, the sporting goods stores were back then. I'm trying to remember the name. But, you know, they were pretty readily available, and they had the hand wraps, and they had the punching bag gloves, which are different than regular punching boxing gloves, and speed bags, which, you know, take a little bit of working to rig up. You gotta hook them up above. So, you know, we had a pretty good basement for that. They had a really good basement for that with a fair amount of space to do these things. And sooner enough, you know, we had the equipment, and we were just giving it a whirl. We also had a book, an instructional manual. Again, I credit my older brother with all this, written by Floyd Patterson, former champion in the 50s and early 60s. And it was a very clear and excellent manual for how to throw the core basic punches of boxing: the jab, the right cross, the left hook, crouching, bobbing, slipping punches, tips on training, all this kind of thing. And again, I never went and formalized it, never really went to a trainer or ever went to a gym. You know, part of me wishes I did. The other part of me, I think I just don't think I ever had really the nerve to plunge into the environment that way. I think I was comfortable with my two older brothers. That was plenty of competition for me, and I enjoyed it at that level, you know. And we did, one of my brothers, we went to the same college, so we ended up doing it pretty much through college, and then we kind of hung up the gloves.
Right. Yeah, you tell us after having your jaw really smashed in one of these little informal fights or maybe just training rounds.
Sparring, yeah.
Yeah, hung up the gloves. And I'm just curious, were you in other respects an athlete? I mean, engaged in let's say more kind of mainstream athletic endeavors? And if so, how did boxing figure kind of in the middle of all that? Did this feel like just one more sporting endeavor for you, or did this feel like something completely different from the rest?
I played some sports. I mean, I loved sports and I loved playing them, but I was very my poor mom, you know. I never liked joining things very much. I was not a group dynamic kind of kid. I reluctantly joined a baseball team and a football team for a year or two at a time, but I never stuck with it. I loved playing baseball out in the street, pickup games with my friends. I loved playing touch football. I liked boxing with my brothers, but I didn't like doing any of this in any kind of formal, organized way. I always resisted that for whatever reason, and I think part of that is the boxing attraction was that, too. Again, there was this kind of autonomous, solo nature to boxing that really appealed to me. In high school, I did wrestle for several years, none too successfully. Had almost no success at all. In fact, I joined that because I thought that, they don't have boxing anymore in schools, but this will probably be similar. Well, it wasn't very similar. So
Floyd Patterson's book didn't come in handy, huh?
No. It gave me no assistance at all. Hmm. So, yeah, there were a bunch of sports around, but boxing did kind of have a special place.
Right. A last question before we dig into some specifics in your book. As you were at the top of the interview describing this kind of solitary nature of boxing, that is, despite the fact that it's typically fought in arenas with thousands and thousands of screaming fans, mm-hmm. it is still, when you step into the ring, you are alone there, save for your opponent and the referee. And oddly enough, I'm reminded of the sport that I probably follow more closely than any other, well, aside from tennis, which is maybe has the same sort of situation too, but I'm actually thinking of figure skating. Mm. And I remember a moment from an Olympics telecast many years ago when the announcer, as we saw this solitary figure in the middle of her routine, and this huge expanse of ice, and the music is very quiet at that moment. This was said, perhaps the loneliest sport in the world, mm. What he was saying there was the fact that, despite the fact that every champion figure skater has not only a coach but a whole bevy of in a sense teammates and supporters working tirelessly on their behalf. Once you step out on the ice, no one else can land that double axel or triple axel for you.
That's right. All
on you. And I suppose there is a parallel to the world of boxing in that not actually all that far away are people literally and figuratively in your corner, and they're even allowed to scream out advice and instructions and so on. But nevertheless, no one else can land the punch for you. No one else can take the punch that is inflicted on you except you, the boxer, as an individual.
Oh, so true. And, you know, two quick anecdotes on to illustrate that. One of them is not from the book because it involves a fighter who's not a heavyweight, Marvin Hagler, a middleweight from the 1980s, whom a lot of listeners will remember. Great champion. And his one of his biggest fights, he was fighting Thomas Hearns, which was one of the huge money fights of the 1980s. And they were in the dressing room getting ready to come out and go down that aisle, as I said. And these dressing rooms are very adjacently located, I guess, and you could hear through the walls in the other dressing room. And Thomas Hearns was from Detroit, and he had a huge bevy of supporters and Detroit guys, just like kind of like what you were mentioning. They were whooping it up and getting him fired up, you know. He was going to be going out there shortly. And at one point, Hagler turned to one of his people, much quieter dressing room, and he just said, all those guys, he can't bring any of those guys in the ring with him. It's going to be him and me.
Whoa.
And that's the truth.
Exactly.
And then the other quick anecdote is Muhammad Ali in Africa fighting George Foreman, and, you know, famously getting his anguished corner watching him taking these punches on the ropes and get off the ropes. And he would sit down between rounds and he'd say, I know what I'm doing. And of course, he's out there. He's the one living it. And that is boxing is does have that element. Mm.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Paul Beston, and we are talking about his book, The Boxing Kings, When American Heavyweights Ruled the Ring. He really spans the entire 20th century in examining the great Americans who held the heavyweight boxing championship of the world and bore that title proudly, although for some of them it was a weight that caused them all kinds of unanticipated pain and sometimes shame. Paul Beston, I was really shocked in the first chapter called Progenitor, which is about John L. Sullivan, the first great American heavyweight boxing champion, to read something to the effect that at the time that Sullivan began boxing, boxing was illegal in 38 states. And I'm not sure how many states there were, but there weren't even 50, of course, back then.
No.
But in 38 of them, boxing was illegal. Can you just say a quick word about the illegality of boxing and what kind of effect that had on the sort of the whole nature of the game or sport back in the days of John L. Sullivan?
Sure. Yeah, boxing was generally illegal. I mean, it was 38 states. That about covers it. Late 19th century. It was illegal. It was considered essentially a criminal act, a criminal enterprise, the effect it had on the sport was, of course, that it created a kind of underground. It created a interesting. We're talking about scarcity. I mean, here is scarcity, and of course, the fans of this, which, by the way, the old-time expression for them was the fancy. They were called the fancy. They were people, the fanciers of pugilism, you know, who would travel distances and make all kinds of sacrifices to get to wherever these remote and often secret locales were that were going to hold these fights. But they were deeply embedded in gambling and all kinds of illicit activities that were also, you know, of questionable legality. So boxing was bound up in that kind of world of sort of vice and illegal activity from the very beginning, and that kind of those kinds of trappings have sort of followed the sport ever since. But the way that people were able to do it in that climate was that a lot of states and cities would have ordinances that would basically permit what they called exhibitions, boxing exhibitions, demonstrations of the scientific art of self-defense, you know, that kind of thing. So John L. Sullivan, for example, was able to give these exhibitions in Boston often, or in other cities and states, and that's kind of how he got started. And then invariably what would happen in these kinds of things is in these kinds of events is that a fight would break out, and in fact it would usually be kind of hush-hush that all along it was going to be a fight, but they're going to work under the cover of this basic law. This is an exhibition, you know. Sometimes police would break up the events at some point, saying, well, this is clearly not a sparring exhibition anymore. But that they kind of use the rubric of those laws that gave at least a semblance of permit to get the thing started. Other times they just went outright and evaded the eyes of the law and found a locale. But they were usually pretty badly kept secrets. People found out about them quickly, and often the police knew about them because the police were both enforcer and sometimes enabler.
Hmm. You call John L. Sullivan the George Washington of boxing. But and then you go on to say, I mean, we all kind of understand what you're saying there, but you go on to say he was America's first sports superstar. And it's important for us to understand that this was at a time when professional sports here in America was very much in its infancy. And probably the notion of anybody being a sports star, let alone sports superstar, was probably ludicrous. It would probably never occur to anyone, never cross anyone's mind that could even be a possibility.
Yeah, I mean, just the whole sort of definition didn't even really exist. Just as before Sullivan, the whole sort of definition of what the heavyweight championship and the heavyweight champion were going to be didn't really exist. I mean, there was a title. It was kind of colloquially recognized, passed along from fighter to fighter, but it didn't have the kind of standing that Sullivan was going to give it. And a few years ago, a guy named Christopher Klein wrote a terrific book on bio of Sullivan called Strong Boy. Very good read. And he had a great point. He said that Sullivan is, I mean, here's a different metaphor for Sullivan. He said Sullivan was sometimes called the Babe Ruth of boxing. He said it should really be the other way around. Babe Ruth should be called the John L. Sullivan of baseball. because you know, he was a generation ahead, and he really did kind of create this new idea, not just sports celebrity, but in some ways celebrity itself, because, I mean, you look back at that time, we didn't have, you know, the mass newspapers were really just starting to become a phenomenon in American life, so and a lot of them were just starting to add sports pages, and he was a big influence on that, too.
Right.
So he had a big impact on kind of the whole leisure culture that was developing that, you know, before this time in America, there wasn't really, you know, what we know of today. I mean, you know, we spend so much of our time thinking of sports or fun or movies or what we're going to do on the weekend, and that was all pretty new back then.
Right. And I don't think we've also said this, that you tell us he was not only America's first sports superstar, you also call him America's first working class celebrity. So in other words, the fact that he had such powerful impact on that particular facet of the population, which was also the largest, certainly, facet of the population, that was also something quite groundbreaking.
Yeah, it was, and again, it goes back to that the kind of a steady sort of democratization of American culture. You know, I mean, you can even see it in the trail of the presidents. You know, from those first run of presidents from what they called the Virginia Dynasty. You know, these very elite the very top people in the country, and then you slowly start to see people like Andrew Jackson and men from working class backgrounds, obviously Abraham Lincoln, and from then on, you know, the president starts to become much more sort of a man of the people kind of thing, as opposed to sort of Olympian kind of figure, and it's the same thing in the broader culture too, you know, that people from the working class all of a sudden are having an impact on the country's taste. And, of course, baseball is another huge factor here, because that was really a completely working class activity at that time. We don't think of it necessarily that way now. But, you know, baseball was coming in also with the founding of the National League. And so these things are all happening in concert. And then all these other factors, too, such as the railroads being finished. And so, you know, transit becoming more possible. So Sullivan, a very enterprising man, he took the title on a national pilgrimage, just traveling by train for, you know, something like a year on an incredible tour, and taking that title around the country, making himself into this figure. I mean, it wasn't like anybody gave him the idea or that it had existed before.
Hmm. You also tell us that John L. Sullivan, probably from the start of his career, was very likely an alcoholic, and certainly by the end of his career and by the end of his life, there was more and more evidence of that, or at least, you know, for most of his boxing career, alcohol played a very prominent role in his life and his pleasures. In stark contrast to James Corbett, who defeated him in 1892, known as Gentleman Jim. And we don't have time to talk about him in any detail, except just to make the point that, of course, one of the things that's so fascinating about this sport, and one of the reasons you were so fascinated by it and why it's such fertile ground for a great book, is that you have these figures that are so in such striking contrast to one another. And there's something about the sport of boxing in which we see them up close and we know who they are in a way that you really don't, even on, for instance, a football field or even a baseball field, where they're just a little more distant and somehow a little more shielded in one way or another. Not in boxing. Well,
yeah, it's wonderfully said and absolutely right. You know, they even their fighting styles reflect their personalities. You know, I mean, Sullivan could be very bombastic, and certainly when he was drinking, he was certainly even more so. He was a blustery kind of guy. He believed in himself. He boasted. He was also a very generous man, very gregarious, had no pretenses, and he fought in this way. You know, he didn't have any art. He didn't really have any art or science to what he was doing. He was ready going out there and club the guy and win the fight. James J. Corbett, you know, dashing and fancy dresser, and how does he fight? In this new kind of defensive and more scientific style. So it really fits the personality, and you can see that all throughout the story.
Hmm. We're speaking with Paul Beston about his book, The Boxing Kings, When American Heavyweights Ruled the Ring. Of course, one of the figures who really looms large in this parade of champions is Jack Johnson. And you title his chapter Pariah, because, of course, that is ultimately his destiny. But before that, he is one of the most famous people in the world. One of the things that says something about the world in which Jack Johnson rose to prominence and ultimately won such prominence was something you tell us about a film, the film that was made of his, I believe, his victory over Tommy Burns. That was in 1908. I think that's maybe when he gained the title. That is Jack Johnson. Tell us what was done to the film of that fight. The end of that film.
This was a fight that took place in Australia, in Sydney, Australia, and I should back up a little and say that by the time 1908 rolled around, this thing, as I described, this heavyweight title had become, you know, slowly, or not that slowly, quickly becoming a sort of an institution, becoming a commercial prize and something that Americans identified with the country. And, of course, in the racial climate of that time, the idea of a black man holding that title was very threatening to millions of people. And so there had been essentially an agreement that blacks would just not even get a chance to challenge for the title. In fact, Sullivan made it explicit in an announcement that he would never fight a black fighter. So no one had gotten a chance at it. And Johnson got his chance not only because he was the outstanding challenger, but because the champion at the time, Tommy Burns, a Canadian, essentially set a very high price, $30,000, which doesn't sound like much now, under the strong confidence that no promoter would ever pay such a thing. And that way he could just say, hey, I said I would fight him, but nobody will pay me. Well, guess what? Promoter came up with the money, so they went to Australia for the fight. Johnson just trounced Burns as one of the most one-sided title fights in memory, and it was filmed. You know, parts of it still survive today. But I got this last piece of information from Jeffrey Ward, who wrote a very comprehensive book about Johnson called Unforgivable Blackness, which was also part of Ken Burns based his documentary on that. And I had always read before then that what had happened was that just as he was about to, just as Johnson was about to have the climactic blow in the 14th round when Burns was ready to be knocked out, that the police had stormed the ring and cut off the film. They were getting ready to get into the ring, but Ward found through his research that an original print of the film actually did show Johnson in victory. In other words, the idea was that they didn't want anyone to see him in this final moment of triumph because it would be you know, too alarming, too shocking for Americans to see. What I didn't know until reading Jeffrey Ward's book was that the original footage actually did exist of the final victory, but it was then edited out, cut out of subsequent films. So it's lost forever at this point. So
right.
For our purposes, it may as well have happened the way that it used to.
Right, exactly. But it was thought that the sight of that would have been intolerable to the typical white American, certainly.
That's right.
You tell us that James Johnson rose as part of the generation of blacks who were born free, but in an age of racial retrenchment. And so it makes his rise to greatness in some respects all the more astonishing and impressive. But of course, as many people know, Jack Johnson is also a figure who is remembered almost more for how he lived his life outside of the ring in terms of discarding just about every social and social rule of decorum of the day. How would you have us remember him? I mean, what do you think is most important? I mean, should we discard the one and only think about the other, or do they all matter in terms of his importance and significance?
Well, I think I say near the end of my chapter that in my view, he might be the most complex of all of these characters, and I don't think I have, you know, a full beat on him myself. He's a complicated figure, and he was a man of remarkable intelligence. You know, what's interesting about him is that when he was born in 1878, both his parents were literate, which was pretty unusual for a black child to have two literate parents in 1878. I mean, Reconstruction was just ending, and you know, getting literacy and all these other opportunities for blacks was hardly universal. So he had some advantages, and he was literate himself, and all of the Johnson children were literate. His parents were very determined to get them educated, and so he was a very, very, very bright man. But he was also just almost a chronic kind of self-mythologizer. You know, his stories about himself, I think I also say in the chapter, really can't be verified without secondary sources. You know, he has an autobiography in which he's telling stories about his early travels, and one of which he's fighting a shark. He single-handedly kills a shark who's attacking his fishing boat or something. It's just, you know, it has this ring of just, you know, absurdity to it. It's highly entertaining. But, of course, this this went along with his presentation to the public. He was very, he had no lack of self-confidence. He also had no lack of courage. He was not afraid of white condemnation, and that does make him really remarkable at a time when you know, it wasn't just a disapproval that you could risk running, but death, certainly violence. He really crossed the white line when he was getting involved with white women. I mean, that was the thing that finally, it was bad enough for whites that he was holding this world title, but the fact that he was consorting with white women and eventually marrying them was just a bridge too far. That was the ultimate primal fear of all, was interracial relationships. And the other aspect of it, though, that Johnson added to the mix was that most of these women, not all, but most, were prostitutes. So he had an absolute delight in prostitutes and in vice. He loved nightclubs and drinking and fast cars and fancy clothes and the whole thing. So he was a man who just wanted to live his life with pleasures. And he would often run into criticism from blacks, too. Booker T. Washington was no friend of Jack Johnson. He thought he was a terrible example for the race, as it was called back then. And so he caused a lot of blacks discomfort, too, because of their fear that he was going to bring, you know, basically arouse hostility that they were going to end up paying for. Because, in fact, and this did come to pass in some extent, because when he won his most famous fight in 1910, when he beat James J. Jeffries, there were race riots. So a lot of blacks had a kind of mixed feeling about him on the title, because they were very proud on the one hand, but on the other hand, many of them wished that he would live more quietly.
When we turn to the next great champion, a guy by the name of Jack Dempsey, in a chapter called Million Dollar Hobo, you tell us about his impressive rise out of a very unpromising beginning. I mean, a hard youth and early on in his boxing career, all kinds of really discouraging reversals, which would seem to give no indication of the great champion that he was to ultimately become. You tell us in the year 1918, he has the most dominant year in all of heavyweight boxing, 19 wins, 17 by knockout, 12 are first round knockouts. This is when he's just on the edge of becoming heavyweight boxing champion. This guy who comes up from the trenches, from very much a working class background and very limited education. But I was very surprised to read in this chapter that Jack Dempsey often at his fights was booed. Tell us more about the way in which he was viewed by the public and how his impressive victories were often seen and received by the public.
Yeah, Dempsey was a figure like a lot of modern celebrities. He has that kind of love-hate. He prompts those kinds of conflicting emotions in people. On the one hand, people absolutely loved him because he was so magnetic as a fighter in the ring, and he's really the guy who brings this faster, real frankly more violent style of fighting than had been seen before, and many people would see 50, 60 years later a successor to that style and approach in Mike Tyson, who in fact did admire Dempsey. So as a fighter, he was an electric attraction. But on the other hand, he was coming along right in the wake of World War One, and World War One was a traumatic social experience in the United States, as it was in obviously in the European countries. But the whole issue of serving in the military was just a huge one in the country, and able-bodied men who did not serve for whatever reason were called slackers, and that was an old-fashioned usage of that term, not like today where it's kind of got a kind of flight from social responsibility, sort of started with sort of Generation X kind of thing. But this was really about manhood. A slacker was someone who was half a man, who was refusing to suit up and fight for his country, was essentially a coward. Dempsey did not fight in the war. He got a deferment from the government. He pleaded that he was the sole support for his parents and some siblings, a widowed sister. The deferment was approved. His case on the surface was perfectly legitimate. On the other hand, you have to, you know, there are certainly plenty of tens of thousands of other American men who probably could have, you know, made the same case. Everybody has a life, after all. Everybody has responsibilities. So he, when he won the title, people began to look back at that, and he heard plenty of criticism in the sporting press. He heard criticism from Stars and Stripes, the military newspaper, and eventually when he started getting in the ring against other opponents, a substantial portion of Americans were rooting against him, even when he fought a Frenchman, which is kind of hard to believe today. But the Frenchman he fought in 1921 happened to be a war hero for France, Georges Carpentier, and a lot of Americans were rooting for Carpentier against Dempsey, who they saw as a slacker. So he had a long time living down that reputation.
And of course, in your book, we can read all about the important fights in his career, including the that famous fight with Gene Tunney, the man who defeats him and defeats him again in that famous long count battle. And we learn so much more about this intriguing figure, someone whom we know the name well, but not always the man. And of course, you also paint for us a rich, detailed portrait of one Joe Louis, a towering champion in the 1930s and 40s. One of the things I learned from your chapter on Joe Louis was the fact that the timing of Joe Louis's emergence was, in a sense, just right in terms of the American public being ready for that color line to be crossed again. Tell us the way in which that was so.
Yeah, Louis came along he ended up winning the title 22 years after Johnson had lost it, Jack Johnson had lost it, and in that span of time, no black fighter had been given another chance at the heavyweight title. You know, I was describing how the people didn't want Johnson to get the chance. Well, after Johnson, they say, well, see, I told you that was a bad idea. We're never going to do that again. So there was a ban on, you know, essentially a ban on blacks getting a shot at the heavyweight title. Dempsey did not fight the leading black challenger of his day. And so it was a long time before Joe Louis came along that this opportunity came along again. Louis was so good, was such a phenom in running through the ranks that was one part of it. He was just creating excitement. And this was Depression-era boxing now, and boxing was looking for a shot in the arm. You know, attendance was declining, and people, you know, just didn't have money to go to fights the way that they had. So he was creating a sensation. That was one part of it. And, you know, it had been, there were attitudes slowly changing anyway. And the last thing with Louis was that he had a management team, that was very determined to avoid any of the buttons pushed by Johnson. So they devised a whole public presentation plan for him that would make him as inoffensive as possible. You know, he would never gloat. He would never, you know, gloat over white opponents. Needless to say, he would never be seen with white women. That kind of stuff. That whole list of rules drawn up. The interesting thing about those rules, though, and they're often remarked upon today, obviously very much a result of their time and you know, very condescending to read today. But on the other hand, the interesting thing about them is that most of them Louis would have ended up following anyway, because that was the kind of person he was. He was not a gloating type. He tended to be pretty stoic. He had a slight speech impediment. He had learned to speak late. He was always a little shy about, you know, too much speaking. He was a man of few words. And so he was very comfortable letting his fists do the talking and letting other people do, you know, project whatever they wanted to project upon him. He was okay with not being a kind of Johnson figure. So it worked fine for him. He was a perfect fit for it. And then the fighting ability did the rest.
Of course. And it's very interesting in this chapter to read your account of how the sports writers of the day wrote about Joe Louis and how they would often resort to very troubling, now for us, troubling racist caricatures in order to describe his greatness in the ring and that long tenure he enjoyed as heavyweight champion. We have just a couple minutes to talk about one of the greatest figures of them all, namely Rocky Marciano, the only utterly undefeated heavyweight boxer of all of these champions. And it was fascinating to read about some of the ways in which he was the unlikeliest of heavyweight champions in terms of sort of his physical gifts and the fact that he was a very much a latecomer to boxing. It's not as though he was honed to be this unparalleled champion right from the start. How can we explain his extraordinary greatness?
Sheer grit. I mean, sheer grit and determination. You know, it sounds trite to say, but in his case, there is no other explanation. He was a very good athlete. He was a pretty good baseball player. He was an excellent football player, which a lot of people don't remember. But he dropped out of high school somewhere in the middle there. I should say he's from Brockton, Massachusetts, not far from Boston, and he was born in 1923, so he was a you know, adolescent in the early 40s, and he served in the war. And you know, he had athletic dreams for sure, but they weren't boxing. I mean, he liked boxing. He did some boxing in the Army, but he really wanted to be a baseball player. And he had dropped out of high school because he wanted to help support his family with work. But post Army, he still had this baseball dream, and he went on a tryout for the Chicago Cubs, and he just wasn't good enough. So he finally went home to Brockton and said, "Look, it's boxing. That's what I'm going to do." And by now, he was 24, 25 years old before he was really starting to pursue this in any serious way. That is extraordinarily late for a great boxer to just even to get started. That's incredible. And then the second thing with Rocky was that he had physical disadvantages, certainly for a heavyweight. He was only, I think he was 5'11". He was more like 5'10", 5'10 and a half. He only tipped the scales at about 185, which would make him just puny today compared to today's heavyweights. And he had short arms, reach as we call it in boxing, which basically dictates how far away you can hit your opponent from. So, you know, the shorter your arms are, that means you've got to get closer to your opponent to hit him. The closer you got to get to your opponent to hit him, that means you're going to have to be more likely in the path of his punches. So fighters with short arms tend to be aggressive fighters. They need to get in close to do their work, and they're probably going to take some shots along the way. And Rocky Marciano could take just about anything that people could give him. So he was the hardest working heavyweight champion. He had the most brutal training regimen, probably even today. He had stamina that was boundless, and it was just, he also had a great trainer, I should say. He had one of the great trainers of all time in Charlie Goldman. So he had great people behind him, great instruction, and just endless work ethic. And
right.
through those factors put together, he became a champion.
And you quote Mr. Goldman, I think, as saying something else, which is so important. He said, "The kid always listened. You never had to tell Rocky anything twice." So not only did he have these great people behind him, but he listened to them and acted on their advice, and the result was an unparalleled career as heavyweight champion. And, of course, we have not even touched on two of the most famous names to current Americans, Muhammad Ali and Mike Tyson, and you have all kinds of great things, insightful things to say about both of those champions and many of the other great boxers who also fought in and around that era. A last quick question. Towards the beginning of the book, you liken the heavyweight championship to the presidency. Explain what you see as the parallel in our last minute or so.
Well, I was getting at both the sense of prominence, certainly the sense of prominence, the sense of fame, in that, you know, everybody knows who the president is, obviously, and most people back then, for a very long time, did, you know, maybe not quite as many, but a lot, knew who the heavyweight champion was. Even if they didn't follow boxing, even if they didn't even follow sports, they just knew who, everybody knew who Joe Louis was. I mean, everybody did. And so there was that ubiquitous sense to that was one part of it. And the other part of it is this sense of this lineage, as I call it. You know, the presidents were, you know, they're famous for thinking about what their predecessors had done. And I mean, I think it was Richard Nixon who used to walk around, you know, in the White House and look at the portraits of the past presidents and think to himself, you know, what should I do? Looking at Teddy Roosevelt's picture and that kind of thing. And there's a lot of that with these guys, too. And as you were saying earlier, the contrast and same thing with presidents. You know, one president tends to be succeeded by a president who usually does things quite differently. And there's a lot of that with these guys, too. A lot of give and take, a lot of back and forth of styles and personalities. And they all were kind of aware of one another, too.
Hmm. You write, like the presidency, the heavyweight championship came with perks, precedence, and boundless opportunity, but also unrelenting criticism, unexpected limitations, and the persistent burden of the past. You explore all of that in such fascinating fashion in your book, again called The Boxing Kings, When American Heavyweights Ruled the Ring. published by Roman and Littlefield. Paul Beston, congratulations on this first book. It is a classic, and I am so glad we got to talk about it today on The Morning Show. Very best wishes to you.
Thank you so much, Greg. Thank you for the time, and it was great talking with you.
Support for WGTD and The Morning Show comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, now newly reimagined for 2019. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what